know the why human trafficking work is needed. To fight for the freedom of modern-day slaves. But love, passion, commitment isn't all you need to be an effective and successful anti-trafficking advocate. Learn the how. I'm Dr. Celia Williamson, Director of the Human Trafficking and Social Justice Institute at the University of Toledo. Welcome to the Emancipation Nation podcast, where I'll provide you with the latest and best methods, policy, and practice discussed by experienced experts in the field so that you can cut through the noise, save time, and be about the work of saving lives.
Hey, Lisa.
Hey.
Hey, the guest we have today is the author of 190 publications. Can you believe that?
My mind's blown. I'm not even sure I know that many words in the English language.
I know, right? I mean, it takes a few months for somebody to get published, maybe up to 6 months to really get peer-reviewed, published in a journal. And you have 190 articles. I can't even do that math. Like, I'm not even sure how many of those are peer-reviewed publications, but probably quite a few. But yeah, I can't even do the math on that one. Let's just say she studied her issues and she knows it.
And what is the issue she's going to be talking about? And tell me a little about her. Who is she?
Well, it's Dr. Lisa Najavitz, and she's talking about trauma and substance abuse, which I know goes hand in hand. You experience trauma, and then sometimes you use drugs or alcohol to cope with your trauma, or vice versa. And like, once you get on that train, you know, how do you get off that train going 80 miles an hour?
Right. And, you know, we often saw that when we were epidemiologists for the state substance abuse monitoring system. You remember?
Right. Like, heroin addiction has just grabbed hold of a lot of people. And the fact that fentanyl is really involved in all types of drugs now, it's just really scary.
Oh, it's really dangerous. And, you know, you would think like people working in substance abuse treatment in the field, if they only knew that what they're really battling underneath the addiction is trauma in essence, I mean, you know, I feel like they would be running towards being more trauma-informed.
Right. I have to say that just because people get confused all the time, though, they think being trauma-informed is the same thing as trauma treatment. And it's really not the same thing. Like, being trauma-informed is having, you know, your agency and the way you talk to people, the way you greet people, the policies, the programming, all the things should take trauma into consideration. But trauma treatment is something that's done by counselors, by clinical therapists, and it's a treatment modality or a series of modalities. But people are specifically trained to be trauma treatment counselors, not the same thing. Like, we should be trauma informed in all our agencies and things, but we should also send our clients to trauma treatment, trauma trained counselors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I run into people and they're talking about their client has trauma, and so they're going to get their agency trained in trauma informed care. And I'm like, that's, I mean, very good. And your client is also going to go to trauma treatment, right? And they're like, yeah, that's what I just said.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, when it comes to clinical counselors, people are just like, oh, just go to a clinical counselor. But it's like, you know, my analogy is like when you go to a lawyer because you have a specific problem, you should go to a specifically trained lawyer. So if I wrote a book or whatever, I want to go to an intellectual properties attorney. Or if I'm accused of a crime, you know, I want to go to a criminal defense attorney. Or if I'm at a university, I don't just go and just take classes and then someday somebody's going to give me a degree. I mean, I have to go to a specific college within the university, like the pharmacy college or the engineering college or the college of law if I want to be a lawyer. Or if I go to the doctor, you know, I have a specialized problem, they're going to send me to a specialized doctor whose specialty is that thing. But when it comes to counseling, people are just like, well, you know, just go to counseling. And that doesn't always work out. If I have a client, I want you to go to a specifically trained, I want to see that you have a certificate, a certification, you have some treatment modality that, you know, my client can take advantage of.
Right. And I think a lot of times people just think of counselors as all being equal. And I mean, equal by meaning they provide like just the same treatment as every other counselor. And that's just, it's not the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm excited. So this, Lisa, is it Najavitz?
Yeah.
Okay. She's the real deal then, huh? Sounds like it.
Yeah. I think once you hear this interview, you'll be convinced that in addition to getting your clients that have suffered trauma to a good trauma-trained therapist, that you as an advocate can come alongside them and help them address their trauma and their drug addiction by using some of Lisa's material. So without further ado, my interview with Dr. Lisa. Welcome to the Emancipation Nation podcast. Today we have Lisa Najavitz, and she is an adjunct professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and she's also the director of treatment innovations. So she was on the faculty of Harvard Medical School for over 25 years. She's been a research psychologist at Veterans Affairs Healthcare System in Boston for 12 years. She's consulted with, you know, SAMHSA, National Institutes of Health, Department of Veterans Affairs Administration, just all kinds of major government and non-government entities. She is a powerhouse. And I remember just being a practitioner back in the day and finding some of her materials, which we're going to mention today. And they were really so powerful, so helpful in with the women that I was working with, and her, and that was, I don't even know, like almost a decade ago or more. And those materials are still very, very relevant because they get to the core issue. So I'm so excited. I just happened to email her. I looked at her book and I thought, huh, I wonder what she's doing. And I emailed her. And she emailed me right back and said, yeah, I'd love to be on the podcast. So she's still very active in what she does. And she's even going to talk about research studies that she's currently involved in. And she needs a little help out there with some of our advocates. So thank you and welcome, Lisa. I'm so happy that you had time to join me.
Thank you so much. And I am thrilled to hear about the work you do and your network of people who are trying to help victims and survivors of trafficking. I just think the work you are doing is unbelievably important, and anything I can do to help, I want to.
Well, and Lisa, you know, many people have used your materials, have successfully helped survivors of all kinds of violence and experience. So yeah, you've been amazing in the work that you do. So tell us a little bit, I know you do work in the area of trauma, but also trauma and substance abuse or substance use disorder. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. Early in my career, I was working on an addiction study, and what came to light was that a lot of people who have addictions also have trauma. And of course, that makes sense. I think we would all say at this point, duh, right? It's obvious that people don't turn to substances for no reason. Typically, they have had a really tough life, whether it's from child abuse, from trafficking, from any kind of trauma we can imagine, domestic violence, from military service, and so on. So I became early in my career very interested in this connection. And at first, I thought it would just be a few years. I would focus on that and then move on to something else. Well, here I am over 30 years later and feel like I've just tapped the tip of the iceberg. It is such an important connection. And we know that people often reach out for substances, but also other addictive behavior when they've gone through overwhelming, painful events. They reach out for substances. They also reach out for things like gambling, food, internet, pornography, sex. Some people, it's excessive work, it's excessive exercise, it's any kind of excessive behavior that's designed to soothe, but ultimately can be used too much.
That is so interesting. And so how did you come about, talk a little bit about how you took this research and really translated it into the Seeking Safety book that made it so easy to understand and help people to work through issues? How did you even come about that?
Yeah, basically, I got my first grant in 1992. So I was brand new in my career, had just completed training in clinical psychology. And this first grant was to develop a treatment related to substance abuse and trauma. And what I really began to think about was, how might you address trauma in the context of this incredible vulnerability of addiction? Because we know that when people are in the throes of addiction, active using, their lives are chaotic. They're often in very unsafe relationships, unsafe situations. If you try to take them back into their trauma story at that point, you're going to unleash what we call Pandora's box. You're going to unleash this flood of emotion and memory that may be way too intense for them at that point. So essentially, what got conceptualized was, what if we just focus on safety? So we're still talking about trauma every step of the way, but we talk about it in the present, not going back into the trauma narrative. And so the idea is, we focus on coping skills and education. So instead of going back into what happened when and who did what and what that felt like, we go into, how does it impact you now? And what can you do about it? If you're having flashbacks, if you can't sleep at night, if you're having nightmares, if you're getting into struggles with people, if you feel like you have no energy or motivation, if you want to die, what can you do today? So Seeking Safety was developed as a way to provide each topic, each session of Seeking Safety is a different safe coping skill. So for example, there are interpersonal skills. So for example, asking for help. How can you just ask for help right now? Setting boundaries in relationships. How can you set healthy boundaries? And on and on. There are cognitive skills. So for example, creating meaning. What are the meanings, the stories you tell yourself, and how can those be shifted toward recovery? Behavioral topics. For example, taking good care of yourself. How can you just find ways, even if you've had neglect or abuse or other things, how can you find ways to take healthy care of yourself? We have a gazillion topics, so it seems, but it's 25 topics, but we also have a wider list of safe coping skills. And throughout the model, we go into the concept of empowerment, that there's not one right way ever. There are a myriad of different ways, and it's up to you to figure out what will work for you. And if something doesn't work, let it go, try something else. And even though we have a lot of different coping ideas in Seeking Safety, what we always encourage is, come up with ways that work for you. You may come up with ways that aren't sitting here on the page, but that you have discovered or you want to try out. And as long as it's safe coping, it's good coping.
I love that so much, because in the anti-trafficking world, we always, always, always attend to safety, because of so much trauma that has happened throughout our helping relationship as we engage survivors. We always have to be cognizant of safety and being trauma-informed and trauma-responsive and all the things. But some of us don't understand how to translate that into practical day-to-day engagement, or we can't explain to survivors how that manifests in real life day to day. And that's what I like about the Seeking Safety manual, is that there are coping skills. You touch on behavioral, thinking, feeling, all of the ways that you can help yourself or help survivors to learn coping skills to increase their safety. I mean, that is very practical. It's taking a lot of research and making it very practical and handing somebody the tools to be able to do that And so that's why I'm really a fan. What's the entire name of the book? Is it just Seeking Safety? Or if people looked for it, what should they be looking for?
Yeah, the title of the book, if one Googles Seeking Safety, you would find it. The longer title is, the subtitle is A Treatment for PTSD and Substance Abuse. And I'll just mention that because the book was published a while back, it came out in 2002. Sometimes people see the title and think, oh my gosh, I better diagnose PTSD or they have to have substance abuse. But in the many years that it has been used, it's used very broadly. People don't have to have full-blown PTSD. It's any trauma. And they don't have to have substance abuse or another addiction. It's the way we think about it, it's and or. If someone has substance abuse and or trauma, then they are they can use the coping skills. I will just hearken back because, Celia, I love what you just said about safety. So I'm going to hearken back to, there's a beautiful classic book in the field. And if people haven't read it, I just think it is one of the essential readings on trauma. And it's Judith Herman's book, Trauma and Recovery. And she published that book in 1992. And she actually lays out the stages of recovery from trauma. And the first stage is safety. The second is what she called mourning and remembrance, which means essentially grieving the past, what happened, and working through that intense trauma narrative. And the third stage, reconnection, creating a good life going forward. And I'll just mention that it's sort of a little twist of history here, that what happened was I didn't actually read that book until I'd already been most of the way through developing Seeking Safety. And then I came upon that book and basically it was like, oh my gosh, safety, you know, there it is. That's the core concept in the work I'm developing. And so I just really, I think it's a wonderful book to read for anyone who's interested in this area of work. And also I feel very indebted to Judith Herman's work. I'll also mention one other person who is less well known, but I went to a talk early in the 90s by someone named James Chu, a psychiatrist, who, when I was at McLean and Harvard Medical School, and I remember he ran a unit for people who had very severe PTSD, and he talked about how you can actually work on trauma in the present. So those two were really points of inspiration for me, and James Chu has also, there are articles he has written over the years. You can find them on Google as well, but I just want to do a shout out to those very important early people writing about trauma.
That's awesome. So if people were to use the Seeking Safety guide, how do you suggest they best use it? Is it best one-on-one in group? Do they give it to their clients to do? How does that work?
Yeah, great question. So basically, Seeking Safety can be done in group or individual. And I would say most programs do it as group because most programs really can't afford to, don't have access to enough providers to do individual. So it's been used in both. And basically the format, all of the material is identical, whether it's done in group or individual. And I appreciate your focus on practicality. So I'll just mention briefly, the session starts with a check-in that's just brief to sort of see where the client is at or the person is at. And then it moves into the material. It also has a quotation that's designed to be a point of inspiration at the beginning of the session, trying to really connect with people emotionally. And then there's a checkout at the end just to make sure it wraps up on a positive note. So it has a structure that seems to work very well that can be done in group or individual. I will mention also that there is another model called Finding Your Best Self that I worked on over a many year period that was published in 2019. So that's more recent. It's completely separate from Seeking Safety, but I'll briefly mention it here because it was really designed to also tap into the many people and systems where there may not necessarily be people who feel comfortable picking up a book like Seeking Safety. Seeking Safety is used very broadly. There are some people who just get it and use it. Seeking Safety does not require formal training or supervision, certification, none of that stuff. It's very public health oriented. Anyone can use it. It's been done by peers. It's been studied and scientifically found that peers can do just as well as professionals with it. So Seeking Safety can be used broadly. But I had always had in mind that I wanted to write a self-help book for trauma and addiction. And that became this other book called Finding Your Best Self. So I'll just briefly mention that one because that one can be done with even without a provider present or a peer or a support or an advocate. It can just be a person themselves who wants to dive in a little bit and try to explore trauma and addiction. So Finding Your Best Self is basically 35 short chapters, and it was designed that way so it would be sort of short bites, short little pieces that a person could absorb. And the material is more updated than Seeking Safety. Seeking Safety, it's still totally valid material, but it's not updated, for example, for DSM-5. There will eventually be a new edition of the book some years out. Finding Your Best Self, it is all current, very current material, and it's less expensive than Seeking Safety. And I mention that because often clients or people don't have a lot of resources, programs don't. So the Seeking Safety book, just for what it's worth, we always tell people when they contact us, I'll just say it here, the lowest cost way to get it is on Amazon. One can rent a copy or get a used copy. Finding Your Best Self is just less expensive, even on the front end. And the model has in it, one of my favorite parts is it has recovery voices with each chapter. And that is the voice of someone themselves in recovery from trauma and or addiction who speaks about how that chapter relates to their own recovery. And I feel incredibly indebted to all the survivors who wrote a segment for these chapters, because I think it brings forth the voice of survivors. And that is so often a needed point of inspiration for people who are right in the midst of their struggles. So that part I really like. It also has a lot of exercises that people can do directly. And I'll just name a few examples of the types of chapters to get a feel for it. There's one, for example, on social pain. What is it like to feel stigma, to feel devalued, to feel kind of like a throwaway? There's a chapter called How to Survive a Relapse, which is what do you do if you kind of go backwards, whether with trauma symptoms or addiction, how to pick yourself up from that. There's a chapter called What the Wounded Can Give Back, which is about how so many of people in the field themselves have their own history of trauma and or addiction. There's a chapter called The Decision to Grow, the idea that one has to kind of make a decision to keep growing, to be able to progress in recovery, and how to kind of own that decision. So on and on, many different ones. But I just want to highlight that because whether Seeking Safety or Finding Your Best Self, the goal of these is practical materials.
That is so awesome. I am so glad that you've done all the work for us and we can just order the guides and we just do the work because, you know, everyone has their place and their space. And, you know, our advocates don't have time to go and reinvent the wheel. They're doing the work. And so if they can have access to these types of tools that can make them even more effective in their work, like that's just going to be all the better. So, Lisa, you're continuing to do research. And so I know you have some studies that you're involved in now. And, you know, can you tell us about them and how can we help?
Oh, thank you for that. I always feel like I have had three different places in terms of my work. So one of them is doing research. I've been a professor throughout my entire career, and I really value how one can try to make a contribution and try to hopefully help the field grow by looking at the big picture, really doing the studies, doing the science to be able to say what works and what doesn't. And to have the humility to say we can develop all kinds of things and they may or may not work. And so I've really valued throughout my work retooling and revamping based on results and based on feedback. I never think of it as me sitting in a room alone just coming up with this stuff, but it's really based on what I hear and what I hear back and so on. So the research is always an important piece, and thank you. I will be happy to tell you about a couple current studies we're doing. The other piece I really value is teaching, and I've had the opportunity to go all over the world and really have learned so much from working with frontline people who are doing the work. And I always think of it as any materials, any books or materials I create, they're just words on a page, but it's people who pick it up and bring to it their spirit and their dedication to the people they work with. That's what makes it come alive. So that the teaching piece has always been important. And the third piece is I've always done direct clinical service myself. I've always had a practice, whether it's been hospital-based through most of my career, sometimes private practice, just the many ways one can directly interact with survivors themselves. So coming back to the research piece is one of the three pieces of that work I do. We have a couple of current studies, and we would love for people to get the word out because I think it is such a win-win-win. Basically, anyone who participates in our studies, they get paid with Amazon e-gift cards. People can be anywhere in the U.S., and the studies pay somewhere between $115 to $120 U.S., when they go through the steps, when they're eligible and they participate in the study, they get paid with Amazon e-gift cards. They get access, in the case of the two current studies, they get a mobile phone app to help them. And basically, one of the studies is designed to address peer-led seeking safety, which is very dear to my heart. Throughout my career, I've always wanted to try to create methods that can be free or super low cost without barriers to entry, because we know most people will never get access to professional care. And even if they do, the more the better. So free peer-led seeking safety is the goal of one of those studies. And they get free weekly sessions with a trained peer who can provide the seeking safety. And they get a huge amount of supportive material, education, and linkage to their cohort in their peer group. This is a group-led, a group-designed peer intervention. They get that throughout the week. So very excited about that. The other study is for detecting emotions. And we certainly know, of course, people have a ton of intense emotions when they've been through these very difficult experiences. So that mobile app is designed to use high-level technology. It's basically AI, or big data, but it's automated to basically detect what emotions the person is feeling. And by speaking into the camera phone, speaking for a few moments, and then it will feed back what the system detects in your face, your voice, and if you choose to write as well. So that one is designed for people ages 18 to 26. The other study, peer-led seeking safety, is for 18 to 65. And both of the studies, it's very simple. If you just Google, the simplest way I'll just mention, go to our website. If you just Google seeking safety, you'll find our website. It also says treatment innovations on it. And then on the left menu bar, it says join our studies. There's a little, it says fill out this brief form. If someone fills out the brief form, we will then identify if they're eligible to start in, and then we get right back to them about the next steps.
And so with both studies, with either studies, do they get gift cards with either one or just with the peer-led seeking safety?
Both of them. Thank you for asking that. Basically both, and they range, one of them, I don't remember offhand, one of them is 115 and one of them is 120.
That's awesome. And so what is their commitment for each study?
Yeah. So with peer-led seeking safety, Basically, well, with, let me start with both studies. They would be doing assessments, meaning they fill out measures. It's all online. And we try to make it brief. It doesn't take terribly long, but basically they fill out measures on the front end so we know how they're doing now. And then they'll fill out measures at the end so we can see the change. And that's the scientific part where we are trying to learn from them what happens for them. And we also do an interview at the end to find out what they liked and disliked about the app and the experiences, because we want to retool these after the study to make it even stronger in terms of helping people. And I'll add in addition to what they get during the study, they're also making a contribution to help us create better materials to help other survivors. So that's sort of the shared goal. So they basically do the assessments. If they're doing the peer-led seeking safety, we want them to be interested in participating in the sessions. It's once a week for an hour, and we want people who want that kind of help, but basically they just get on the session. It's a Zoom-based session. Most people are familiar with Zoom, but it's basically right there on the app. They click a button, they join the session, and they get that help. And basically then during the week, we hope that they will use the app to learn more, strengthen their skills is the bottom line. With the emotion study, what we are hoping for is that they're interested in learning more about their own emotions and that they will do, we hope, a check-in, what we call a check-in every day on the app to see kind of what their emotions are and how they're doing. But I'll just mention that in terms of requirements, the requirement is just that if they're eligible, that they do the front and end assessments and the interview, and they will get paid even if they skip sessions of seeking safety or even if they don't check in every day on the app. Mm-hmm. Those we're hoping they'll do, but they're not required. The only requirement for getting paid are the assessments and the interview.
And so for both of those studies, you're looking for survivors. Are you looking for survivors of violence or trauma or anything like that?
That's yeah. The main?
Okay.
Well, good question. What we're looking for is with both studies, because we're focused on substance abuse, these studies were funded by the National Institutes of Health to focus on addiction. So people have to have current substance use and actually have a substance abuse problem. And we help assess that. So many people who have a substance abuse problem don't know that they have a problem. To them, it seems just normal. So they don't have to have it diagnosed or anything like that. What we'll do is if they do have active substance use, they can fill out the form and then we'll do further inquiry to find out if they actually have a significant problem with it. So they have to have substance use and some level of they think they might have a problem, they may not be sure. And in the peer-led study, they also have to have some level of trauma symptoms. And there too, people may not even recognize them as symptoms. So we'll assess for that.
Yeah. So when in doubt, just check out your website, like click on and you'll tell them if they're eligible or not, but they shouldn't exclude themselves.
Exactly.
Now, are you also looking for international people or U.S. people?
You know, the studies are required to be based in the U.S. currently, but if people have an interest, anyone is welcome to contact us. We do have on our website a contact us form that they can fill out, and it also has our email addresses, and we welcome contact from anyone, but the studies themselves, they do have to be based in the U.S.
Okay. Okay. And then can you tell us what you are hoping to do with the findings from this study? How will that be translated into some, you know, practical application?
Yeah. Good question. The essence of it is, so we've spent with both of these mobile apps, we have spent over a year developing, actually it's been several years developing these mobile apps. And we've actually done rounds of interviews with people in the past who have addiction and or trauma, to get their input from the front end, to be able to develop mobile apps that we think will be helpful. So we've gotten feedback at several steps along the way, and now the apps are developed. And so in this study, just to mention, both of the studies are what is called a randomized controlled trial. And that means that half of the people will get the apps that we developed to be the real apps, I'll call them. The other half are going to get what we call control apps. And that means extremely minimal, but it's just designed for scientific testing. So I'll just mention that people should be aware, and this is listed in all of our materials, that half of the people will not get the real one. They'll get the minimal one that has just very basic information in it. But what they'll basically be contributing in terms of the science is, at the end, we'll be able to test, did the real app do better than this minimal version? Because we don't want to put something out that is going to be not useful to people. So we're testing it to make sure, what is the impact? Does it help people, for example, decrease substance use? That's our key goal. Does it help them reduce trauma symptoms? That's another key goal. So essentially, basically trying to learn from the individuals what works and what doesn't, both based on their own reporting of their symptoms and then also those endpoint interviews where we learn from them what they liked and didn't.
Wow, that is awesome. So, Lisa, just mention again, how can people get a hold of Treatment Innovations, or they want to be involved in the study? We know, you know, look for the Seeking Safety book on Amazon. Is the other book, Finding Your Best Self, is that on Amazon as well?
Yes, the other book is on Amazon as well. And it also, I think there are some used copies or things like that. Sometimes libraries have these books, that kind of thing. And our website, I'll just mention, the simplest way is www.seekingsafety.org, or just Google Seeking Safety. You'll find our website and it has our contact information. We also have every study done on Seeking Safety or other models that that we've worked on. And you can freely download the research reports. You can also read the evidence base on these models. We try to provide a ton of information. We also have some downloadable materials that are like examples of topics from Seeking Safety. If someone doesn't want to go and, you know, dive in and buy the book, we try to provide anything we can on our website. So the publishers of the books have allowed us to provide some free downloadable chapters from the books. You can take a glance and see if it feels like it will fit.
And Lisa, you know, somebody doesn't spend 30 years, like you said, working on in one area without a reason. How did you become so passionate that kept you in the game so long?
I definitely appreciate that question. So for me, what I would say is my first love was doing clinical work. And so I went to graduate school in clinical psychology because I wanted to do therapy and counseling. And that has remained always my priority. I just really care about what one can do sitting with another individual. And that's why I really also appreciate, Celia, the work you're doing and also your entire network, that they are directly working with people. Now, when I got out of graduate school, what I found was that managed care had just taken over in Massachusetts. This was in the early 1990s. And a clinical career was looking a little more difficult or tenuous. There were just a lot of changes happening at that point. And I did have, thank goodness, due to the background I got in my graduate program, I did have a really strong background in research. And so there was an opportunity to get a job in research as a project director of a big clinical trial trying to help people with substance abuse. And I thought, wow, that sounds super interesting. So I got involved and was hired as the project director, and one thing led to another. And then I really saw that research could have an impact and could try to take on questions you can't take on necessarily in just that day-to-day one-to-one or small group kind of scenario. So that became the research focus. I will say from a personal level, I myself had experienced trauma due to a violent assault back while I was in graduate school as a young adult. My family experienced very significant trauma themselves. So trauma really spoke to me in terms of my life history as well.
That's awesome. Well, Lisa, any parting words you would have for people who are trying to do this work day in and day out and trying to be effective and trying to do a good job and trying to also take care of themselves?
Yeah. A couple of points. One of them is what you just said about trying to take care of themselves. Absolutely 100% that it's so important to keep doing one's own work. We all are doing it to try to really keep growing, to really keep, while supporting other people, learning how to support ourselves and get help that we may need. So that is crucial. And the other point I'll mention is that to never take for granted that the work you are doing is the most important work. You are helping other people. And that sort of altruism is what keeps us all alive, keeps us all being able to go forward. And it's such a complex network of people helping people that can help undo the damage of trauma, of addiction. And no one can do it alone. So to keep doing what you're doing, I have the utmost respect for the work that I have seen, you know, very directly people doing out there helping survivors. And I just value that enormously. So I want to thank everyone who is doing that work.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
You know, I think of this podcast as you really trying to connect people to the best possible, you know, information and materials. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those guests, you know what I mean? Like that really brings great usable information to the table.
Yeah. Like I used her old book before, the Seeking Safety book. And like she said in her interview, you know, the title is Seeking Safety, a Treatment Manual for PTSD and Substance Abuse. But you don't really have to have a client with a verified diagnosis of PTSD. I mean, I used it with some of the survivors that I was working with when I did direct service. And it was really a staple of mine. If her new book is anything like her old book, it's got to be life-changing. I mean, because I think about the number of years she spent studying the issue after she wrote Seeking Safety and how much more she knows and is able to put into this new book. Like I ordered it. But I haven't gotten it yet, so I don't know yet. But and I don't do direct service anymore, but I like to keep up. And, you know, once in a while, I'll run a women's group just to keep my skills up and stay in touch and sort of stay grounded. So
you do the same thing with rap music, actually.
Actually, I do. Yeah. I like to stay up on my rap music. Yes. So that I can
check in.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Understand what's happening. So absolutely. I know she has a couple of books. She mentioned the Seeking Safety is what I love. She is just on fire producing these materials that help people.
And I mean, it sounds like that's her style. Like 25 years at Harvard is impressive. And now she's at University of Massachusetts Medical School. So she's been on fire. Mm-hmm. She had to have been like a whiz kid. And like, she looks so young.
I know.
I think she has a great name.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, doing what you love helps keep you young. Like I'm old, but in my heart, I feel 38, you know, so because I love what I do. But when I did do direct service, Lisa's work certainly informed my practice and it really helped guide what I did.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I wanted to mention that, you know, I feel 62, but I look 25.
So, yeah.
But just kidding. But, you know, I think we all have those guides in our lives like Lisa, and some of those guides we clearly know are our guides. They're in our circles, and some guides, you know, we never even meet. But we read their work, we watch their documentary, we listen to their speeches or whatever. And, you know, it's weird because they never know how much they impacted like our daily lives and the work we do.
I know, like Lisa's using her science in service of others. Everything she knows about the topic, a culmination of her life's work, is poured into these workbooks. And this is just genius. Like, very few people take time to do this. So she took her high-level science and translated it into everyday language so that the facilitator can use the information with their clients. She doesn't need to do that. I mean, she has the Harvard name. She has the Boston School in her background, right? She doesn't need to create a user-friendly guide and a workbook for the practitioner to use to help other people who are suffering with trauma and addiction. So when you read it, like, it just makes so much sense too. But why does it make sense? Because what you don't know is the years of her designing studies just right, and then getting the funding to do the studies, and then implementing the studies, and then making sure you have reduced all the limitations related to the study, and then getting a representative sample, and then asking all the right questions, and then analyzing the findings correctly, publishing them in a peer-reviewed journal so that other social scientists review your methodology and say, yeah, this is good enough to publish. But she goes further then and translates the research into real user-friendly language so that practitioners and advocates and facilitators can actually use something that works. And where does that come from? I don't know, like deep down in her spirit. But I would guess it comes from her own experience with trauma and victimization and her own like real genuine desire to help people. And it reminds me of this John Kennedy quote, you know, we're not here to curse the darkness, but to light the candle that guides us through the darkness to a safe and sane future. So I think she's using her science and her authentic self to help other people. And Lisa continues her research. So she mentioned that she's currently doing more research. So if anyone's interested, get involved with her research. Please do it. You just saw how her years of work is making a difference in the lives of other people. So until then, the fight continues.
Let's not just do something. Let's do the best thing. If you like this episode of Emancipation Nation, please subscribe and I'll send you the weekly podcast. Until then, the fight continues.